We are in conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We know him as the public face of fighting this COVID pandemic, especially in the early days as our nation looked for an expert for clarity and to tell us how to defeat this virus. He is an institution in public health and in battling infectious disease, having advised seven presidents, now chief medical officer to President Biden. Dr. Fauci has served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. He's been a physician for the National Institutes of Health for more than a half century. I spoke with him Tuesday afternoon. Dr. Anthony Fauci, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So all over the country, including here in Wisconsin, states have reopened, masks not required, businesses starting to get back to normal. Are we moving too quickly?
Well, it depends on what the level of vaccination the community is. I mean, if you have a very high level of vaccination, you can expect the level of infections, the number of infections per day, the weekly average of daily infections to become very, very low in your area. So I think you have to take a look at what the level of vaccination is, what percentage is. And if it's high enough, I think that getting things open and getting back to normal, I don't think it should be an all or none phenomenon. I think under certain circumstances, depending upon the dynamics of the outbreak in a particular area, you're still going to have to do the kinds of precautions that are recommended by the CDC.
Many scientists are now saying that we'll never reach herd immunity. Is COVID-19 here to stay?
Well, we better be careful because we don't know exactly what the percentage of the threshold of herd immunity is. You know, the concept of herd immunity is that you get enough people vaccinated together with those who are infected, who have recovered, and who are now, at least for a finite period of time, protected against reinfection. You put that together, if you have enough people, whatever that threshold is, we don't know whether that's going to be 70%, 85% of the population. We don't know. So I think it would be premature and probably not accurate to say we will never reach herd immunity. First of all, we're not completely certain what that threshold number is. So my response to that, when people say that, is to we should get as many people vaccinated as quickly as we possibly can. And you will get to the point where if you get enough people vaccinated, you will see a dramatic decline in the number of daily infections. That will be herd immunity when you get to the point where virtually no one is getting infected because the population is protected by the large number of people who have been either vaccinated or previously infected.
Do you think we need to achieve herd immunity to beat this pandemic? Or can we start thinking it maybe like the seasonal flu, which is also highly transmissible?
It's very difficult to predict that. We don't know that. We don't know whether or not it's going to hang around and be at a low level. And that's the reason why the solution is get vaccinated. You get enough people vaccinated, you will protect the community from infection, and you may not have to worry about it recurring. But whether or not we're going to see a lower level is unclear at present. So when you look at an infectious disease, you ultimately either eradicate it, you eliminate it, or you control it. And there's various levels of control. We've only eradicated one infectious disease in literally history, and that is smallpox. Mm. By a very effective vaccination campaign. We've eliminated in certain countries a variety of illnesses. In the United States, we've eliminated polio. In the United States, we've eliminated measles, except for those little clusters that occur in regions and areas where people are not vaccinated. That's what elimination is. Control is when there's infection that's there at various levels, hopefully a very low level, but it doesn't cause disruption of society. It is conceivable, and I don't know, and I repeat, I don't know whether that's going to be the case with COVID-19. I would hope that we can eliminate it from our society But that may not be in the cards, at least for the foreseeable future. We may hopefully be able to control it enough so that it doesn't disrupt society the way it is doing right now.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, our nation's top immunologist. Dr. Fauci has been chief medical advisor to the White House since January and is longtime director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. I want to turn to our home front here in Wisconsin because we have seen, you know, Democrats and Republicans fighting bitterly over our response. We've had, you know, fights over shutdowns, over mask mandates, over schools reopening, vaccine distribution. And we had the nation's highest infection rate for a period in the fall. We also led the nation in vaccinations for a period this spring. What do you make of Wisconsin's response?
Well, one of the things that I have said several times over this period is that it is unfortunate that we are living right now in an arena of considerable divisiveness within our country. That is unfortunate because we have a common enemy. The common enemy is the virus, not each other. We might have differences, and those differences should be respected. And those differences, in some respects, can even make us stronger. But when political differences or profound divisiveness in society get in the way of a uniform, smooth, effective response to a pandemic, that is unfortunate. So I would hope that we can all pull together to end this to the point, as we mentioned just a little bit ago, where we either eliminate it or we control it at a very, very low level.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is chief medical advisor to the White House, has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. Dr. Fauci, I want to look for a moment here at science. How can we rebuild science? I mean, skepticism of science in a pandemic isn't a new thing. You saw it unfold in the AIDS crisis. How do you rebuild trust in science? How do you root out misinformation?
Well, you know, it becomes more difficult, particularly in this era of social media, where you wind up having anyone can say anything, and then it spreads like wildfire. And it's very difficult to counter that. I think the only way to do it is to continue to bring out the facts in a way that's understandable for people, to be consistent and to be transparent. But you're right, misinformation is really very, very destructive of an adequate and appropriate response to a serious situation like the pandemic we're facing like now.
What do you see as your role and your response to eradicating this misinformation and elevating science?
Well, it's what I've been trying to do, is always speak the truth. Sometimes the truth is an inconvenient truth to some people, but you've got to continue to collect data, information, and evidence. And I think sometimes what people get confused with is that science is a dynamic process. We know things much better and much differently now than we did in January of 2020. And as things evolved, how you look at this pandemic, how you address it, guidelines, policies, and things can change. And that's not flip-flopping. That's being open-minded enough and flexible enough to continue to be guided by the facts and the evidence as they evolve. If this were a static process, we would know everything we needed to know right from the get-go. But it isn't. It's a dynamic process that continues to evolve. And science, by its very nature, is self-corrective. That you learn something today, and then you find out that as the situation evolves, things might change, and you have to be adaptable enough to make changes as new truths and new information come out.
We're talking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, our nation's top immunologist, who became the public face of the federal response to COVID-19. He's chief medical advisor to the White House. We will pick up our conversation and get to a listener voicemail. Sue from Darlington wants to know about the future of vaccinating children and whether students should wear masks in the classroom in the fall. We'll be back in a minute with more from Dr. Fauci here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're in conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He's worked with seven presidents, from Ronald Reagan to now as chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden. Much of his long career in public health has focused on researching viruses like HIV/AIDS and the effects on the immune system. When we talked Tuesday, I asked him about new treatment breakthroughs for COVID patients, and this came up because recently, we heard on our program from infectious disease specialist Dr. Mary Beth Graham from the Medical College of Wisconsin. She had expressed frustration, along with her colleagues, that there haven't been new therapeutic advancements for treating severely ill COVID patients at this stage in the pandemic. And so I asked him about this and what to do about long haulers to prevent further suffering and death.
Well, there are three aspects, I believe, to your question. There's the treatment early on for people to prevent them for the need for hospitalization. There's treatment of people with advanced disease because the mechanisms of both of those are different. And then there's the situation with what we're calling long COVID or long haulers. We have reasonably good therapies now that we've learned over the last year for advanced disease, because when you get advanced disease, it's more of an aberrant destructive inflammatory or immune response that's less related to the virus and more to an uncontrolled inflammatory or immune response. We've done much better over the last several months than we did early on because we've learned a lot about how to treat individuals. What we need to do better at, and we're putting a considerable amount of resources into this process right now, is to develop drugs that are directed specifically against the virus to treat people early in the course of their infection so that you can prevent them from the need of going to the hospital by blocking the progression of their disease. We have things like monoclonal antibodies, which are really good if you can get them early enough to be used in individuals. We have some direct antivirals, not a lot of them, and that's what most of the effort is directed in, trying to develop new targeted antiviral drugs to treat people early. Then there's the situation with long COVID. We really need to understand what the mechanisms of that are before we actually can do anything about it, because the mechanisms whereby people have prolonged symptomatology that's unexplainable by any recognizable pathogenic process, like profound fatigue, muscle aches, temperature dysregulation, unexplained rapid heartbeat or tachycardia, sleep disturbances, and what people refer to as brain fog or an inability to focus or concentrate. That is a real phenomenon, and we've now begun to study it very intensively, but we don't have many antidotes to it because we don't know what the pathogenic mechanisms are. And that's the reason why we're putting a considerable effort into trying, learning more about that, because it is a real phenomenon and is seen in a substantial proportion of people who recover from the initial onslaught of the virus, but have the persistence of unexplained symptomatology.
I want to take a listener question here. Sue from Darlington called in with this question for you.
When does he think that children under 12 will be getting the vaccine or eligible for the vaccine? And also, does he think that school children in the fall will need to be wearing masks to school?
Well, the situation with children less than 12 years old is now being very actively studied in what's called an age de-escalation manner. We know now that we have the emergency use authorization approval to vaccinate children from 12 to 15. Those are fundamentally high school students. Children younger will be studied over the next few months and are currently being studied. You go from 12 to 9. If that looks good, you then study kids from 9 years old to 6. If that looks good, you go from 6 to 2. If that looks good, you go from 6 months to 2 years. It is likely that those studies will be completed by the end of calendar year 2021, and at the latest, as we get into the first quarter of 2022. So it looks like high school kids will be vaccinated in time for the fall term, whereas children younger than 12 will likely not get vaccinated until towards the end of the year, the beginning of the current year. That being the case, the CDC will likely continue to recommend the wearing of masks of children in school, particularly those children of the age that have not yet been vaccinated.
We're talking about the fight against COVID at this stage in the pandemic and the road ahead for public health with Dr. Anthony Fauci. He serves as chief medical advisor to President Biden. Dr. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984.
What about, you know, air traffic and bookings being so far up, airlines adding hundreds of flights this summer? Are you concerned about Americans traveling abroad in the pandemic and the risks of variants?
Well, travel historically with COVID-19 is a risky procedure, although what's going on right now with flights, with the mandate to wear masks on flights and more people getting vaccinated, the risk becomes less and less, particularly for people who are vaccinated. That's one of the reasons why we encourage so strongly for people to get vaccinated, because you'll be able to safely do many of the things that you were not able to do before vaccines became available. With regard to variants, fortunately for us, the dominant variants that are going around in the United States are very well handled by the vaccines that are now being utilized in the United States. We have to stay alert for newer variants to make sure that they don't evade the protection of vaccines. But currently, the vaccines that we're using right now appear to be working very well against the dominant variants that are in this country.
Do you suspect we'll need a COVID vaccine booster shot later this year?
I don't think we can make that determination right now.
Uh-huh.
It is likely that sometime in the future, since the protection of a vaccine may not be infinite, as it were, namely go on forever, but we don't know exactly when. We want to prepare for the possibility that we might need a booster in addition to the regular regimen sometime within a year or so, but we don't know that. It could be much longer than a year or so. So we need to do the studies, which we are doing, to determine how long the protection lasts from the vaccine regimens that we have now, namely the prime boost from Moderna and Pfizer and the single dose from J&J. We do not know for sure how long that protection lasts, but we're doing studies to determine that. And the results of those studies will determine whether or not and when we will need a booster.
Dr. Fauci, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is chief medical advisor to the White House, longtime director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And in the throes of the pandemic, he became the face of the fight against COVID in our country. We spoke Tuesday afternoon. You can find more reporting on our interview at WPR.org. Coming up, we talk with Dane County's newly appointed Sheriff Calvin Barrett. He assumed the position last month. We explore his leadership vision, his approach to use of force. What questions do you have for Dane County's new sheriff? What do you want to know about Barrett's background or his priorities in policing? Phone lines, they're open for you. Join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll talk with Dane County Sheriff Calvin Barrett after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking with the new sheriff of Dane County here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers appointed Calvin Barrett to replace David Mahoney, who stepped down last month after 14 years as sheriff. Barrett will serve out the remainder of the term that ends in January 2023. Barrett comes to the job having served as a Dane County deputy sheriff and an officer with Sun Prairie's police department. He taught law enforcement and criminal justice at Madison College, served as faculty director of the Criminal Justice Studies program. What questions do you have for Dane County's new sheriff? What do you want to know about his background or priorities for policing? It's 800-642-1234. Sheriff Calvin Barrett, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you so much for having me this morning.
Well, let's start with semantics here. You call yourself a peace officer and use that term to replace police officer. Why do you say peace officer?
Yeah, well, peace officer really just comes down to a mindset and a philosophy that I've developed over time by reading literature and reading the state statutes here in Wisconsin in regards to us, our purpose being to maintain the peace as sheriff deputies. And I mean by peace officer, not in regards to a lack of enforcement of laws and ordinances, but rather a simple mindset that focuses on the community engagement aspect of our job, proactive problem solving, and evidence-based approaches to community reduction. So as peace officers, our philosophy is to explore all reasonable means of problem solving and rely on taking law enforcement action as a last resort.
How is this mindset, this approach received with officers? Have they used the term or have officers asked you questions about being called it?
Yes, absolutely. Officers have asked about that, and the explanation has gained a lot of popularity just in regards to understanding what our mindset is and our philosophy. It really just refers to the idea that if we see ourselves as peacekeepers, that will illuminate in every aspect of our in our lives on and off duty.
You were a science teacher to middle school students and a coach in Texas before becoming a deputy sheriff here in Wisconsin. How does that experience inform how you want to see officers work with kids and relate to kids?
Oh, yes. Being a seventh and eighth grade middle school teacher in Texas was a great experience. I learned a lot from the students and really learned a lot about myself, too, as an educator and as a young man. And I believe working with our children and our youth is one of the most important aspects of our professions, as they are our future. Every hand that I shake, every sticker badge that I hand out as sheriff, every high five or elbow bump that I give, every child that I let sit in my patrol squad and turn on my lights will eventually be one of my deputies that I'm going to swear in. They're going to be one of my peace officers. And I realize that. And I also want our deputies to realize that, too, that the youth that we interact with in a positive way are going to be our partners one day, or they're going to be the individuals that we call supervisor one day. So it's very important that we invest in our youth and provide them with the time and the the time and attention that they need in order to grow, because they are our future, and we have to ensure that they have a great understanding of what we do and how we do our jobs as peace officers.
Do you think they're getting the time and attention from officers? How do you think officers can improve their interactions with kids?
Yeah, it starts with, you know, taking a sheriff's office wide mindset of community oriented policing. Now, I know we do have community police officers here that are designed to work specifically in specific communities throughout Dane County, but office wide, we have to all take that approach, not just in our communities, but also in our facilities as well.
Do you support programs that place police officers in schools or school resource officers, as we hear them called?
Yes, and I do, because my experience is much different than that of those in other parts of our state or our country that may have had negative interactions with school resource officers. Growing up in San Diego, California, I still remember the name of our school resource officer. His name was Officer Cutler, and he was the coolest, buffest, nicest, had the coolest hair, and could dunk a basketball at that time, which was huge for us in elementary school. And I see how important that played in my understanding and of what a peace officer was and their role. It wasn't just enforcement, but it was mentorship. It was big brother, big sister. It was someone who I can speak to confidentially in regards to issues that I was going through at that time, as my father was a law enforcement officer. So I did have someone that I could lean on in our schools that really helped. So my perspective of a school resource officer is much different than those who may oppose it, that see it as a negative tool or a negative presence in our educational institutions.
So even at the elementary school level, because, you know, critics would say their presence creates these unintended consequences like suspensions and expulsions and arrests, and especially far and away for students of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really understanding the role of a school resource officer is important to educate the general public in regards to that. Is that, you know, in our schools, we are not there as an enforcement arm. We are really there as a last resort and as a mentor and as someone that can really provide perspective and understanding and really be there as, in a support role more than an enforcement role. And I think that's really important for everyone, you know, for us to educate our communities in regards to our, you know, our main goals of being in those schools.
I want to look more closely at use of force. You're a father of two daughters, and they bear witness to the Black Lives Matter movement, the killing of George Floyd, and learning the long history of police brutality and systemic racism. When did you decide to have the talk about being Black and how to interact with police?
Yeah, we started in our family. We started very early, just in regards to being aware of who we are and how society views us at times. We felt as a family, my wife and I, that we can try to avoid it. But when our children were coming home and bringing stories of how, you know, they were viewed differently or how they may have been treated differently, we felt at that time it was they were ready for that conversation. So we started it very early. And though both of my children are indeed biracial, they have darker toned skin. And so we have to take that into consideration when they're out in public and there are conversations and things that we've had with them at a very early age to ensure that they are doing everything possible to make sure that they're not seen as a threat, whether it's in the community or whether it's with law enforcement or, you know, just being in society in general.
Does being a parent yourself influence your philosophy toward policing, toward how you guide officers?
Yeah, and it's something that's very important. I mean, no matter what uniform I wear or what job position that I have, you know, I am Black, and my life does matter, and so are my children, and their lives matters as well. So I think just bringing the perspective of my personal and professional experiences to a sheriff's office as a leader really is important, and them understanding the perspective of something that has never been seen before, ever, in the history of the sheriff's department or sheriff's office until now, and that's an African-American sheriff. So my life experiences, my professional experiences, my educational experiences really bring a unique perspective to how I lead the sheriff's office.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dane County Sheriff Calvin Barrett about his background, his priorities in policing. With your questions as well, what do you want to know about his priorities and what he would like to do as the new sheriff? 800-642-1234. You are a lead instructor on defense and arrest tactics in training new officers. When should officers be allowed to use force?
And I believe officers should be allowed to use force as a last resort and after exhausting all means of non-force related actions. And again, as a defense and arrest tactics, are the definition of DAT, which is what the acronym breaks down to, is a system of verbalization skills coupled with physical alternatives. So right there from the beginning, we tell officers, we tell our sheriff's office deputies that our number one goal is communication and de-escalation. And that's in our definition. And it's coupled with physical alternatives, not physical punishments, alternatives, because our goal is to gain voluntary compliance. And if that includes conversations, de-escalation, professional communication skills up front, and only resorting to use of force as a last resort. And that not only is taught in our law enforcement academies throughout the state of Wisconsin, but it will also continue to be taught here at the Dane County Sheriff's Office as long as I'm the sheriff.
Is there enough cultivation, enough training, enough advancement in de-escalation? Does it get the attention you think it deserves?
I think it's gained more attention recently here, but in the curriculum that we have in our state law enforcement curriculum for our academies, it's implied in every aspect of what we do, especially in use of force. So it's all throughout the curriculum in our law enforcement academies. Though it hasn't been technically termed de-escalation, use of force is always our last resort, and communication and gaining voluntary compliance is always our number one goal. And can it be taught more? Absolutely. As a trainer and educator coming from the academic side of the criminal justice system, we can never have enough training and we can never have enough education.
What does the training and education say about blocking someone's ability to breathe, what we would commonly call a chokehold?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. And what I think, what I would love for the listeners and what our communities to know is that in different parts of our countries outside of the state of Wisconsin, is that many law enforcement agencies may use a chokehold as a control device or a way to control an individual who is out of control. Here in the state of Wisconsin, as long as I've been a law enforcement officer, we have never used, taught, or even discussed using a chokehold or blocking off someone's ability to breathe as a way to control them. Chokeholds are not banned in our curriculum, but they're seen as a last resort and are at the level of deadly force. Meaning if an officer has assessed the situation and feels that the use of deadly force is authorized, then a chokehold can be used if they can articulate an objectively reasonable use of that chokehold in order to save their lives or the lives of someone else.
What do you make then of legislation that is working its way through the legislature that would ban chokeholds? Is the legislation warranted?
Yeah, it's something that needs to have additional conversation, and that's something we spoke about in detail in the speaker's task force that I was a part of, and really understanding and educating really what not only a chokehold is, but also a lateral vascular restraint, which is the restriction of blood to the brain, which can cause someone to go unconscious. So additional conversations need to be had to understand and educate the purposes and where exactly a chokehold falls in our use of force intervention options as Wisconsin law enforcement officers.
We're talking with Dane County Sheriff Calvin Barrett is here. He assumed the job last month. Do you live in Dane County? What do you think your newly appointed sheriff should know How do you feel about reducing jail populations? Do you support that goal? How do you feel about community policing? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Dane County's newly appointed Sheriff Calvin Barrett, what he brings to the job. And Sheriff Barrett is with us for 10 more minutes. Jerry is joining us from West Alice with a question. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you for your service. I'm a old white guy in Milwaukee, and my mixed-race son lives in Madison, and I know you're going to take good care of him. The thing that I think needs to happen for us is, I mean, black people know that they're what's happening to them. And I think the police, in a way, know, and the law enforcement community knows the problems that are happening with them. I think someone has to go out to us old, conservative white guys and tell us, explain to us one more time why it is that blackness is seen as a threat and the people on the fringeness and why these kind of beliefs, mistaken beliefs, are so common that they get everywhere. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Sheriff Barrett.
Yes. Yes, that is an excellent question, and thank you so much for calling in your time. I think as coming from the academic side of the criminal justice system, that education is key, and that is one of my top priorities is community engagement and getting out into our communities and educating all of the Dane County residents in regards to where we as a profession have come from, where we are currently at, but more importantly, where we are looking to go in the future. So thank you so much for your question. I really appreciate your trust and your trust in not only me as your sheriff, but in our sheriff's office deputies and taking care of your grandchild who is biracial. So thank you so much.
What have you learned from serving on the Assembly Task Force that, seeks ways to address racial disparities in our state?
The number one and probably the most important thing that I learned on being on the task force is that it is indeed possible. And I hope that we have set a national model on understanding how working collaboratively with the community can come to reasonable solutions to issues that we find in our communities. In these meetings, we had a great opportunity over the past 6 or 7 months to not only learn about other law enforcement agencies and their policies and procedures, but also from community members who have experienced both good and bad and what they feel is important and what they feel we need to do as a profession to move forward and treat everyone in all of our communities in an inclusive manner. We also were blessed with opportunities to hear from community members who have been affected by those who have not used their force in a justified and in an appropriate way. And it was just a very educational opportunity that I will stick with me for the rest of my life.
Yes, what I'm hearing, there's a lot of listening that went on through this task force, a lot of opportunity to really reflect on what people were saying. Was progress made?
Yes, I believe it was an opportunity for relationships to be built, for barriers to be taken down, and for us really to, even if we didn't find consensus or agreement on a specific topic, that we really just disagreed on the idea or the topic and not the individual. And we really learned that we all have the same common goals. We just have different paths or journeys to which we feel we need to get there.
Dwayne in Wausau would like to ask a question. Dwayne, hi.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to know if the new sheriff heard about the law in Texas, I believe, that was passed where you could carry, open carry a handgun without any permit or training. And, I have hunting rifles and shotguns, grew up with guns and scouts with a BB gun and a .22, so you learn to respect them. But what he feels on that,
open carry laws without permits, Dwayne is asking about, Sheriff.
Yeah, and I don't haven't been able to read up on the exact specifics of that, but I think education and training is one of the most important aspects, not only of our profession, but anytime you're dealing with a weapon or anything that could take a life or injure other people. So I think education and training is important on the front end. And without knowing the specifics, that's what I can speak on that topic at this point. But thank you so much for your question.
We're talking with Dane County Sheriff Calvin Barrett about policing, his background, his priorities, your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Jack is joining us from Caledonia. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, how you doing? Question about resisting arrest. Person resists arrest, nothing happens. You know, he finally gets arrested and he's taken to court. The judge gives him a little bit of a sentence for resisting arrest. But if the arresting officer, if it goes south, you know, during the arrest and ends up, you know, shooting the individual, he can lose his job. He can, you know, be sued, go to jail. So my point is, resisting arrest, could we make it where it's more of a penalty to resist instead of just a little slap on the wrist, since the actions of the police officer, you know, can end him up in jail?
Right. And that is something that is really handled on on a higher level in regards to the legislature, who actually writes the statutes and creates the punishments for violating those, but also too on the level of the courts and the judges who make those decisions. And I believe that's very important to have that division of power, right? Because officers, we enforce the laws that are written by a separate entity of our criminal justice system, which really allows for shared power and shared governance. So I really believe that addressing that on those levels is a better option than having us address it as officers. But there's definitely some work that could be done, and we just have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
I want to land here on Dane County's jail population. You want to reduce it. What are your top-line priorities, your top-line reasons for making this a goal?
Right. And coming in to this position and learning so much in the first 3.5 or 4 weeks that I've been here, it's really understanding that as the Dane County Sheriff, I have limited influence or zero control over who comes in. If officers within Dane County have the appropriate paperwork and they bring them into our facility, I have to take them. If probation and parole sets a sanction on an individual and has the appropriate paperwork, I have to take them within our facility. If a judge sentences someone to time in our facility, I have to take them. So really understanding the role and understanding the control that I have over the past few weeks has really been educational for me. So in understanding that, I understand the piece that I have, and the most important piece that we do have control over is what we do when they're in our custody. And focusing on the programming and providing a space that can allow us to treat and provide training to individuals while they're in our custody, so that when they are released back into our communities, they are not committing the same crimes, and we've provided them with the tools they need to be successful and to reduce our overall recidivism. And I think that's one of the most important keys that I have as the Dane County Sheriff.
Sheriff Barrett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Calvin Barrett is Dane County's new sheriff. He was appointed by Governor Evers to finish the term of David Mahoney, who resigned last month. Just ahead, it is an hour-long conversation devoted to exploring new music by Milwaukee artists. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.